This is the Art of the Hudson Valley, broadcasting on WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, Greene, and Columbia Counties, New York. Broadcasting locally on 90.7 FM and globally online at WGXC.org. And I'm your host, Chad Weckler. Today in the studio, we have two wonderful guests, Isabel Barton and Julie Casper Roth. Isabel lives in Columbia County, and Julie lives in Albany County. And what brings them together here is their love for writing. They're both filmmakers and video artists. So I want to welcome both Julie and Isabel.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you. And let's go over to Julie first. And Julie, give us a little background about you.
Well, I was raised in Wisconsin, and I moved out to the East Coast for school. And while I was an undergraduate, that's when I began taking classes in video. An interesting story is that my first video course I took to fill up my schedule, and I was in it for a few days, and I hated it, and I wanted to drop it. But I couldn't find anything else to fill my schedule, so I ended up having to stick with it, and I fell in love with video. So after that, I started working, I guess, in video art, and then started doing some work on documentaries, eventually producing my own. Had worked as a broadcast producer for a short amount of time, for about 4 years, and decided that I really missed the creative end of filmmaking and video making. And so I returned to school, where I am right now. I'm finishing my MFA in a matter of weeks. And yeah, that's where I am.
Why did you want to get into video? What was the spark?
I grew up in a household with a father who was really a technophile. He played in a band. He had a recording studio. And even though we didn't have much money, we always had a video camera. So from a young age, I was always playing with a video camera. And also, then by the time I got to college, I realized that I wanted a way to express ideas or to generate conversations other than just writing or talking with people, and saw video as a way of, being able to generate those conversations or start a discussion with other people.
And Isabel, where are your beginnings?
Well, I come from Venezuela, Caracas. I have been in the U.S. since 1974. I came as a photographer and found very soon that I liked writing also. And the only medium that puts the two together is cinema. So that took me into filmmaking. I began by writing screenplays. I still do that, and I have a feature film out that I am going to play a clip of today, a sound clip. The Aspirin Papers, an adaptation of the Henry James novella, which I did in collaboration with my daughter, Mariana Helmund, who is also a filmmaker, and she directed. We both wrote and produced. Other than that, I do my own films. I do video. Of course, you know, the digital revolution has been great for all of us filmmakers, and it's allowed us to have great independence, and we don't anymore have to wait until somebody comes out with the big money to be able to make our films. So it's been wonderful, and I have taken the opportunity to do whatever I want to do in film, and I'm really enjoying it. So I am involved in several projects right now. One of them is one that I have been at for several years, and it happens in the Amazon jungle in Venezuela, and I'm working with a Pemón Indian woman of the Camaracota tribe. It has been fantastic work, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later.
Yes, that would be wonderful. Talking about the digital revolution, what are some of the things that you could point to say how it's been easier for you to tell a story by using the digital process?
Well, you have a small camera that's not a lot of money to buy, and you can keep changing it as the technology goes along. And you have your computer where you can bring all your clips and gratefully do your editing yourself, although, of course, you always want somebody to help you. But it just is such an immense freedom to be able to do it yourself, at least to set it up or be able to accomplish some of the things you have in your head. It used to be that, you know, you had to, like, do something in a Moviola and then send it to a lab before you could even see what you were doing. And now you just put the clips in your timeline and you make a little few changes in the software, and you can see all kinds of wonderful things immediately. So that, you know, it's cost, it's time, it's the capacity to be able to do it and see it right away.
Julie, what is the term and what does it describe when one says a video artist?
That's a question I get a lot, and it's very difficult to define, actually. And I find even in my own process, as I feel like I'm moving away from that title, it's difficult to explain. I teach video art at the University of Albany, and I've taught it at other places as well. And defining what video art is, it's probably not enough to say that it's a creative take on the medium, because there are so many forms that it takes. There's performance. Video art can be very abstract. It can be look more like a traditional narrative. It could be an experimental documentary. So video art, I would say, is, you know, any form of video that, I guess, it's I don't know.
Sorry. Well, if a listener went to your website, juliecasperroth.com, you have a lot of your clips of the projects that you've worked on, and we have some of the audio that we're going to play in the hour of those. Some of them are sort of documentary fiction, you know, adding fiction and nonfiction within the one video. Can you speak about those?
Yeah, I guess I'll start by saying I've always felt very pulled between different genres. That I've seen documentary and narrative fiction and experimental video art. And I've done a lot of work to try to reconcile those genres and put them together. And so one piece, and I can have or play a clip from it, is I Am Stein. And that comes from my interest in documentary and my interest in history and video art. And what interests me about history is the idea that it's built very much on conjecture, that there are facts and there's information that we have, like solid things we can hang on to, but the rest of it is just we fill in the blanks. And how we fill in those blanks are very dependent on who's telling the story as well. So if you have somebody, you know, a white male might tell a historic story differently than an African-American female, or, you know, someone who identifies as queer, because they are going to look for different things in history. So I Am Stein is a video piece that I created last year, and it's an attempt at playing with history and conjecture, and then also looking at Gertrude Stein specifically. And so I asked people of different backgrounds to stand in and speak as if they were Gertrude Stein. And over the course of it, they read up on her a little bit, but then I started asking them questions where they didn't know the answer, and they were supposed to just go with it to make up what they could make up with that information.
So the finished piece, how long is that?
I think it's close to 10 minutes.
And the clip we're going to listen to now is just under a half a minute thereabouts.
Right. It's just the introduction to the piece.
Well, let's get that queued up then.
I will say I created the piece in conjunction with a printmaking show that was based on a poem by Gertrude Stein. And I was just asked to create a companion piece in video to travel with the show.
My name is Gertrude Stein.
I'm Gertrude Stein.
My name is Gertrude Stein.
I am waiting on a friend, so we have some time to talk before he comes along. I think we'll probably just go for a walk and then have some lunch.
Who's your friend?
Pablo. Picasso. New artist, making a name for himself.
I was born in Tennessee, but we moved at an early age to Europe. And I spent most of my life in Paris.
You know, I spent part of my childhood in Paris.
Okay, I think that's it.
That's wonderful. Who was Gertrude Stein?
Well, Gertrude Stein was a great thinker and artist and poet. American, but expatriate. She lived in France.
And she was, would you say, a patron of the arts or a supporter?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, she was a patron of the arts, and she had good friends who were in the arts. As you heard in that clip, one of the Gertrudes mentions Pablo Picasso, and she was friends with them, with Pablo Picasso and with other artists and with other writers too. She was part of this group of people who are doing a lot of interesting work, who are thinkers, creators, artists.
And what is the result that you were hoping for, and did it succeed in people listening and watching the video?
The result that I was looking for, I was just interested mostly in hearing what the stories would be based on the person telling it, the stories of Gertrude Stein. I wasn't looking for accuracy at all. And do I think that it was achieved? I think so, because there's an actress who's in the video, a wonderful actress named Karen Jones, who actually opened up the piece. She's an African-American woman, and she begins talking about Gertrude Stein's relationship or friendship with Josephine Baker. And it's this piece of history where she's able to talk about race relations that I don't know that the other people would have even thought to talk about, because their experiences as a white female or a white male are different, are going to inform how they speak about the past differently too. I mean, and it's an unconscious thing. I'm not saying people do that intentionally, and I'm interested in the stuff that bubbles to the surface.
And sort of a segue we'll make right now and go to Isabel. And you were mentioning the
Aspirin papers. Yes.
And what's the basis of that story?
It's a young, very ambitious publisher whose favorite poet is dead, and he worships him, and basically he considers himself the one that is making his work immortal. And he finds out that his mistress and muse, who he thought was dead, is alive and living. And I have to make a parenthesis here, because the original story happens in late 19th century and in Venice. And I decided, in collaboration with my daughter, Mariana, with whom I wrote the script, to change it over to modern times, present time, and take it to Venezuela instead.
Oh.
And so we found this this little fishing village. We needed a place that was accessed by water, because it begins that way. The story begins in a gondola. So we begin in a fisherman's boat, and we arrive at this African Venezuelan fishing village, and that is also bordered by a rainforest up in the mountains, where there's an old house that is a cocoa plantation from the 17th century. Anyway, so this is the place that takes up what used to be a palazzo in Venice. that setup is completely different. It allowed us to bring in some Venezuelan culture and some of the things we know and have access to, and it created a possibility for also economically to make a beautiful film that we could make with a lot less money. So that's how it's set up.
And when was this film created and completed?
It was shot in 2009. It was finished in 2010. It played several festivals, and it played up here in Chatham, and it also won the award, and it was nominated for several awards in other festivals, but we have not found commercial distribution, and we are still waiting for the right moment, and if not, we're going to go and do it ourselves, and that is still to be announced.
And how would you like to set up the audio that we're going to be listening to?
So the story, so this man goes all the way to Venezuela, to this hacienda, this plantation, to find the muse, and hoping that she has papers of his that he can take by whatever means. And to that effect, he assumes a fake identity. Mm. And so he goes as a writer looking for a place that has a garden where he can write for the summer. And so, but of course, she's a very smart woman. This scene that I'm going to play is where he first meets her. And he's been waiting to see what he thinks of as the great muse, as the one, you know, the beautiful woman that inspired the best lyrics. And of course, she's very, very old. And here's what happens.
Our house is a little far from the town, but it is still very communal.
It's the most beautiful spot in the area. I've seen nothing as charming as this.
Sit down. I can hear very well.
I fell in love with the place. I'm sure you know what kind of impression it can make on a stranger. I'm a very respectable person. As a boarder, you'd barely notice me. As long as you let me enjoy the garden, of course. I can provide you with excellent references, local as well as from America.
I don't care who you may be. I don't want to know. It means very little. You may have as many rooms as you like if you are willing to pay the price.
Well, I will pay whatever you think is fair.
Well, then, $5,000 a month.
It'll be my pleasure to put 2 months' rent into your hands by tomorrow.
Oh. You will pay $10,000 tomorrow.
In bolivares or dollars?
Do you mean in bolivares or dollars?
I think dollars were what you said.
That's very good.
What would you know about it? She's ignorant about money.
I'm sure she has other areas of knowledge.
She had a very good education when she was young. I saw to it myself. But she has learned nothing since.
I've always been with you.
And if it weren't for that?
May I shake your hand? Settle our agreement?
I belong to a time when that was not the custom.
How about you?
Yes, to show we've all agreed.
Will you bring the money in gold?
In gold? Aren't you afraid of keeping it in the house?
Whom should I be afraid of if I'm not afraid of you?
Actually, I'll be your protector, and I will bring you gold if you prefer.
Thank you.
Okay, so here we see the niece who is going to be the piece that the bargaining piece on the table. And he's going to seduce her in order to get to the papers. He'll do anything at any price to get what he wants. Of course, she's on to him, the old woman, and we know that.
That's good. So this film is making the international film circuit?
Yes, it's going to be premiered in Venezuela soon.
Oh, wonderful.
And, we are making, because this was shot with a RED camera, RED camera, which is one of the great video innovations. And it's got great definition, but it's still video. So in order to play in theaters that have no video set up, it needs to be blown up to 35. And this is what's been happening right now.
I see.
So it's going to be ready for that. It's all complicated in the film industry today.
I actually have a question. Do you find that, is it in the States or is it abroad that they're still using 35 millimeter to project? Or that you have to do that for? Or is it just everywhere?
No, in the States too. I mean, we've found that most of the festivals here don't have, you know, we've shown the film on DVD, which is such a loss. Because to go from a red camera, there's like, I think it's twice the amount of definition than a 35 millimeter camera to a DVD that fits in your computer, you know. It's a great loss.
Yeah.
So it's most of the time it's played that way.
Mm-hmm. And most of the time it's displayed in a DVD.
In a DVD.
Yeah, you squish it down to less than 5 gigabytes of information.
Uh-huh. So, yeah. I was asking for the sound bite for this to bring today, and just the sound is 50 giga. So, wow. You know, imagine what the big file is. I mean, it's many, many hard drives of information.
Right.
Is there a process where the DVD, I mean, you know, reels of film would change in size depending on the length of the film, and now we have the CD and the DVD. Is there a different and larger format that could be played when you have a high definition image?
Well, the file is supposed to stay as an electronic file and not go into any kind of tape or DVD or anything like that, but just stay in a computer or in a some form. I'm not an expert on this. My daughter should be answering this question. She's the one that takes care of all these things. But I know that there is different ways. There are all kinds of different ways to do it. And some are actually hooking up your hard drive to their system. There are others in which you go through some kind of intermediate thing that I don't remember what it is. But it never goes into a DVD because a DVD is too small. It stays in some sort of a hard drive. But there's all kinds of problems having to do with projecting. I mean, even if you're going to project in somebody's TV, you have all the different sizes in which the TV, you know, the width and all that. And you end up with having to crop your image or having to squat it or having to, and there's just like endless problems because the technology hasn't gotten to any place where it's stable.
Right. Just to add to that too, I mean, you had asked about the convenience of having everything digital, having everything accessible, but that's another, you know, not necessarily a problem, but another thing that filmmakers have to contend with is just the technical issues of compression and understanding how to get the most the size of the file that you have. And it requires a whole, you know, another group of people or another person to work with in order to optimize, you know, the look of what you're doing.
Well, Julie, you're doing a lot of different projects and you have some of them on your website and you submit to festivals. How do you keep track of all the different submissions?
For myself, I usually keep a chart. I've just had a handwritten chart that I've hung up in my office. Recently, I haven't been submitting to things recently because I've been in school, so I haven't had much time. But I've been fortunate to have people contact me and ask to screen work at different festivals. And so I just try to keep it in my calendar. And then when I am starting to push a project out into the world, like I said, I keep some kind of chart so I know where it's at and who needs what and what the deadlines are. I also have my big list of rejections, which...
That's unfortunate.
It's, well, no, I don't mind it. I like having that there because it's a reminder that, you know, the work that you do is not going to be a perfect fit everywhere. And also, for me, I see it as a goal. If I look at my list and I see that I've been rejected by a certain festival once or twice, then for me, it's a goal. You know, I really want to create something that will play there. I mean, because there are a couple of festivals I'm interested in being a part of at some point.
Well, can you talk about one of your projects, The Maine, and how that came about?
Yes. So The Maine is a feature-length documentary that I finished last year. And it came about because I was kind of spinning my wheels. I had done some video art and I decided I want to make a documentary and I want to make one right now. And I called the owner of a bar in my hometown. It was the first openly gay bar in my hometown and started talking to him and realized he had a really interesting story. So then I sought out to make the documentary. And for me, it was really, it was a big learning process. And it's a project I'm really happy with. Unfortunately, it hasn't been shown in many places, but it's something that I learned a lot from. And so really the premise of the documentary is it's about these gay bars in small towns that were the first really open places for people to go who were LGBT, to go and feel like they could be open about themselves and have an identity, and how a lot of them are falling to the wayside, or how their identities are changing. Now in the 2000s, a gay bar doesn't necessarily look any different from any bar, and it has mass appeal. It's not just for people who feel like they have no place to go. There are lots of straight college students who like to go to them. The crowd has gotten younger. It's just a different place. Mm-hmm. And I have a clip from the Maine, and to introduce that clip, it's an archivist at the University of Minnesota named Gene Treader, who is just a wonderful, interesting person who's collected all sorts of GLBT history, which, again, in a lot of places, especially in the Midwest, a lot of that history is considered throwaway history. And he's become an authority on this history. Mm. And so he was just speaking about the importance of still having a presence as, you know, a gay or queer community, even though it seems like we've hit a point of assimilation in society. And so that clip will highlight what he had to say.
If you take GLBT history over a period of several millennia, it's like a big set of waves. And there are times we are very, very accepted and times that we are very, very persecuted. And generally, if you follow those waves, the times that we are most accepted are the times when we are the most assimilated into the current culture.
Okay.
And, you know, I think of filmmaking and storytelling. A lot of people, you know, I'm speaking subjectively a little bit, the visual can be a very easy thing to put together. Putting a story to the visual, I think, is the most difficult, at least from where I sit. Julie, how do you tell the story in a visual and audio context?
Wow. Well, I'm also interested in what you have to say, but I start with story, or I start with concept, and then I build off of that. And then from there, decide what I need for visuals and what I need for audio, what I need for interviews. But story is most important to me. And I'm actually now starting to move into narrative fiction. And my next project will be a feature-length fiction film. Mm. But I don't necessarily think that documentary and narrative fiction are unrelated, because they both have an arc. As far as visuals go, you want to try to match visual content with what's being said, but also give yourself the ability to speak metaphorically, that there are layers of information that you can include. You have the visual, you have the written content, you have the delivery that the actors or the interviewees, you know, give you in a project. So I think all those things come together to create story.
I think that's a very interesting subject matter. And I think that the impulse, what takes us into making a work of art or a work of communications or any creative endeavor, what is the impulse? I think that's the most fascinating of all questions. And I think that in my case, I think that I go from a concept before anything else. It's kind of like what drives me is a need to figure something out. So I get this idea or this concept. Like, for example, in the case of, I have a film called Julie of the Spirits that is about an artist who lives in Kingston, New York. And it's just a day in her life, and what kind of a mythical day. It's not really one day, but it could be. It starts with the beginning of the day and ends with the end of the day. But she makes a huge painting in between, so it's a mythical day. But in there, I was dealing with how to deal with my own dichotomy of creative life and home life as a woman. And then this opportunity came along to do this, and it was a way for me to take that kind of thing I needed to explore and put it somewhere and use that opportunity to work out my own dilemma. And it was perfect, and I think it happens every time, whatever it is I'm doing with the Making of a Chief, which is the documentary that I'm making in the Amazon, in the Venezuelan Amazon. I have this need to put together all kinds of different parts of my psyche, my history, what makes up who I am. So here I am working with an Indian woman who is trying to piece together her culture, her history, and the history of the great chief that kind of set up the canon of their lives, how to live their lives. So it's perfect, you know, and we always seem to find that one situation that will allow us to explore whatever it is we need to work out in our own minds. Is that how you feel about things too?
Yes, absolutely. And I also having the experience as a teacher, trying to communicate that to students that, you know, you can call from your own life without it being overtly autobiographical, and it's going to enrich your material because, like you said, I know that with my work, it helps me to work out things and to, yeah, to think them through and to give them some kind of form that also allows me to have dialogue with other people who may be in the same situation or may not, you know, and some of the work is just, you know, personal, and it helps me, you know, to figure out things in my own life. A couple of the pieces I've worked on have to do with being a lesbian and also having been Mormon. And my most recent piece, The Veil, that I'm completing right now, is not about me per se, but is very, you know, it's deeply personal because I'm trying to understand some of the issues and dichotomies, as you had said, related to identity and religious beliefs. And then I have another project that I just wrote. It's a feature-length screenplay right now, where I have a son on the autism spectrum, and I'm interested in how he interacts with the world. And I was thinking, as far as concepts go, what if the roles were reversed? What if the world was all on the autism spectrum, and a few of us were neurotypical, a few of us were the quote-unquote normal ones, and how would that world function?
So oh, it's interesting.
Yeah, so it's very much the same type of process.
Interesting. Another thing that I believe kind of we share or ties our work together is the mixture of fiction and reality, the mixture of what you would call a documentary or what you would call fiction. And it's something that people always ask me at film festivals in the Q&A is, why did I choose that form? Why did I choose, say, in Julie of the Spirits, why did I choose to do something where I'm actually seeing a person who is a real person and I'm following her around, but I'm not allowing just the everyday things to happen, but I'm inserting what you would call fictional scenes inside her day? Because, and they're not fictional. Let's say when I was shooting at her house, I would come in and there would be a package from FedEx, and I would just bring it in and say, oh, this was outside. So the sun would open and it would be a ball. So we use the ball in the film. And so she's painting and suddenly the child starts playing ball right in her studio. And the music and the sound of it, of course, is a problem for her as a creative person, but also enhances everything else that as a creative person I'm doing in making the film. And my sound person my composer who was collaborating with me, who was Peter Wessler, who, by the way, has a show here in the station, used that incredibly well to make a soundtrack for the film, an original music for the film. I have a clip here if you wanted to listen to that.
Sure, let's listen to that.
So in this part of the film, Julie is just finished doing a load of laundry, and she's about to fold them. Now, what happens in the film is that every time she gets involved in something like a chore, she doubles up into two people. And one part goes back to the studio and continues her painting, and the other part stays and continues her chore. And Peter Wessler used this very beautifully. He made a combination of two of ways of making music that are his practice. One is electronic music, and the other one is these piano pieces that are so incredibly delicate. So we're going to hear a little bit of this.
Wonderful.
When we hear, the first sound we're going to hear is when she puts a basket of laundry on the table, and then she starts folding, and then she will double up. And when it becomes very lyrical, she's already in the studio.
Thank you.
Wow. So, you know, your description is very perfect because we have our nonfiction lives, which we're doing right now. And in some ways, the fiction are the thoughts of what is in our minds and our dreams. And someone says something, you're looking at somebody, and I, all of a sudden I'm looking at Isabel, and I see rabbit ears forming above her head. And garden scene, and it's just my wandering, but I can keep within the reality. I don't know why I said that, Isabel.
It's fine. Well, yeah, I guess in this case, what people reacted to is, why would I bringing, because of course this is set up. In documentary, you're not allowed to set anything up. Mm. In fact, it's considered to be, you know, you're breaking the rules. So a lot of the things in Julie of the Spirits are set up. Not when she's painting. When she's painting, it's sacred. Mm-hmm. She's painting, and I'm just watching. But I can tell her, stop there. Let me bring something in, and then you can continue painting and do your thing. But I will control what goes on other than how she paints and when she paints. I mean, I can tell her, stop or continue, or I need you to finish the painting. But yeah, it's fascinating because it does bring in an element of fiction. Would you agree?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the problem, well, it's not a problem per se, but people want to call documentary nonfiction. And I think nonfiction is a very difficult category to put it in, because what documentary film is it's a version of reality. And documentary filmmaker does direct the film. There's directing that takes place, unless it's an observational film. But even if it was an observational film where you're just taking in something that's happening, you're making choices about what that story is when you edit it in the end. So there's definitely a fiction to it. And it's supposed to you know, have the spirit of truth and be as accurate a representation of reality as possible. But there's sculpting that takes place.
Yeah, and I think you've hit on the point there, because I think that many times the documentary filmmakers are more opinionated than a filmmaker that's making a narrative piece. Because you can take something from reality and sculpt it in a way that it makes a very clear and very, very precise statement that is an opinion, even if it's based on something that you're just seeing and hearing. It's just how you put it together.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that.
And then other times, for example, in I think it's interesting going back to your work, because you have a kind of political point of view in your documentaries, correct?
I think so. I don't necessarily think of it as political, but political, I've had conversations with people. Yeah, definitely. I mean, especially with the project that I'm doing right now, which has to do with the Mormon Church, there's definitely a part of that that's political, especially because it was created at the same time that we had the presidential election going on. We have Mitt Romney, who's a Mormon. And I was conscious of that when I was creating the piece, because I knew that Mormonism would be at the forefront of the American mind just because it was arriving with Mitt Romney. So, yeah. So I guess there is a social political statement.
And the gay culture also.
Yes. Although I see that one as more of a history film or a history documentary, because I'm interested in the idea that there's this history that's there, and it's potentially lost, not because people don't value it per se, but because people start to believe that it's not an issue. I don't know how better to explain that.
Are you talking about
the main documentary
about the bar?
About the bar, yeah. Right. Yeah, the bar is really a jumping off point for just talking about gay culture and just archiving it and who holds history.
It's very interesting to see two filmmakers like ourselves who in a sense are dealing with similar issues or similar themes, but on the other hand have such different points of view. And I think that in my case, in the film about the Pemon people, here I'm dealing with something that is inherently a social political theme, but I'm dealing with it from a completely different point of view and being very subjective about it. And my choice And to do that makes me make stylistic choices that are, for example, I choose to have everything being seen from the point of view of the Indian woman with whom I'm working, and she's actually the one who's looking for her own culture and her own history. But I also give myself the license to go inside her head. So I have her go to points where she can look out points. And from there, she goes inside her head and starts deducing, coming to conclusions about the things that she has found out through the interviews of the elders that she has been conducting. And that is a great license that I take. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily one that is very, how do you say that, that people like, that people applaud, because it's kind of like I'm taking something that people expect. They expect that if I'm going to work with the Pemon Indian in the Amazon who are endangered culture and have an endangered language, that I'm, why would I not take the political point of view and start asking the questions that are social and political? And instead, I'm going inside her head and trying to figure out what she feels about how she can piece together this thing in a way that makes sense to her personally and to her people, but not from a political or social point of view, but from a personal point of view. Mm-hmm. So it's an issue. We go and we find the subject matters, but in the end, we choose our point of view.
Right.
And that's what makes it wonderful.
I'm curious, do you look at like filmmakers, other documentary filmmakers who do the same thing that
I have you're doing? Documentary filmmakers. I don't think I found, well, I think this documentary would fall into the experimental documentary category, and that takes it somewhere else. But if I'm going to look at documentaries, I like certain documentaries like Errol Morris, who has he never makes a statement. He lets things happen in front of the lens, and he doesn't really have a statement to say, you know, this is what this film is trying to say. And I think that's where, I think that is what guides me. I don't want to have a message. I don't want to have a statement. I want to explore something, and I want it to say whatever it wants to say in the end, or I want the audience, each person, to be able to find something in there, a conclusion that they can come to in their own.
Mm-hmm. Well, Isabel, can you sort of set us up for the making of a chief, and actually for our listening audience, almost transport us into this place where this film is being made, just to sort of give us a context of where are we going physically?
Yeah, that's a very important thing, because the place is so incredibly special. It is considered the eighth wonder of the world, and this is Angel Falls, which is the tallest waterfall on Earth. It is almost three times the height of the Empire State Building, and it goes down in one drop. So it is inside a canyon, inside a rock mountain. These rock mountains in the Amazon forest, it's the very top north part of the Amazon, and it is a rock, a flat rock with jutting mountains that look like tree stumps, humongous tree stumps, and they are prehistoric mountains. This is where the Lost World came from. This is what inspired Conan Doyle. Going there has changed my life, because when you are there, you experience a very primal world that reminds you where we come from. It reminds you how small we are, how we're related to the earth, the whole. And it's very difficult not to come out of there with something that has changed in you, because there isn't an experience that I've been through that is quite like it. Mm. I'm sure that going to the Grand Canyon is a similar experience. Mm. And these people live at the base of the mountain that houses the falls. The mountain is full of caves, and these caves, like in any other ancient culture, the caves are where the magicians did their work, and they still do, but to a lesser degree. So this is very much part of how they live, and they have they talk to the spirits. They have Piasan, who are the magicians who heal through the work of the spirits, and they sing to them, and they feel that they are the ones that keep the world in harmony by singing to a certain species, so that the species will get more populated or less populated, and that way they keep the harmony of things happening in the world, in the universe. So I was writing a screenplay about Jimmy Angel, who discovered Angel Falls in 1936, discovered, of course, for us. Mm. And I went down there to shoot an expedition to the base of the falls. You have to go in a canoe for 3 days to see the base of the falls. There I met a woman who I got into a conversation with, and she was a Kamarakoto Indian, and I asked her something about, I had been reading about a chief of her culture, a very brief description of a chief that was very interesting, and I asked her if she knew anything about him, and she said, that's my grandfather. Mm-hmm. Of course, it was her great-grandfather, but they don't say it that way. But in any case, she told me that he was a visionary, and that the whole community was trying to rescue his teachings because they all lived by his teachings, but nobody had gathered them in any form recorded, and so that the community was trying to figure out how to do it, and I offered my help, and since then I've been working with him. So this film is the beginning of, I start the film with a myth of their culture, so that we get immersed in. And of course, you know, then we go inside one of the caves where the magicians worked, which are incredibly magical. So this is the beginning.
All right. Let's listen.
The tepuis are houses. They are the houses of the spirits, the Imabaris. Long ago, there were huge macaws who ate people. At that time, there was a very powerful Piatsan whose name was Kaikarua. He would take the macaws and other animals who ate people into the caves of Aoyan Tepui. Inside the caves, he would bury them in deep holes and cover them with great rocks so they could never escape. They say that's why we see less animals today. They are all buried in the holes of the caves covered by great rocks. The caves belonged to the Piatsan. They befriended the Imabaris, and they lured the spirits to help them do what they had to do. From inside, they could see everything that was going on outside. Their spirits flew out. They did their work wherever they had to do it.
So this cave is, the caves are inside. The caves have waterfalls that fall into them. And so you're actually going up into the cave. You have to swim up a river with red water that has two huge walls on either side, so that you have to just hang on to something, to a rope or something, and go up against the current to make it into this incredible black rock cave with the great waterfall. And only at noon does the sun hit it, so that the waterfall just glows, and it's the most magical.
So Isabel, where are you in the filmmaking process right now?
I have all the footage a shot, and it's a feature-length documentary, and I need to edit. It's basically what I need, and I have this 12-minute segment but I have edited other pieces, but basically I just need to get to work and edit, and I need to raise some more money to do that.
Now, one of the two things I discovered, both of you, you both had New York Foundation for the Arts involvement, and I know Julie was part of a NYFA MARC program that I was also involved with. You've also gotten a stipend, SOS, from NYFA, and Isabel, your fiscal host for the making of a chief is also the New York Foundations for the Art. Is that ArtSpire?
That's ArtSpire, yes. So I am one of the projects that they are sponsoring fiscally.
So if people wanted to make a donation,
it would be tax deductible, yeah, for them, and it would be wonderful for me.
Absolutely. It's a win-win situation for everyone.
Absolutely.
And you know, obviously, artists, if we're creating funding like this, is very, very helpful to keep one continuing to create. Julie, you're making lots of films. I'm sure you put not only your own time and your own funding into it, but how do you solicit outside funding?
Well, I have to say that's something I have to get better at. I've been fortunate to get a couple of grants, but grant money and opportunities are drying up a little bit, especially with the economy the way that it is. I know I actually sat on the grant panel for film and video at NYFA this year, and you know, NYFA told us that some of their funds have been pulled back because they get funding through NISCA, the State Council on the Arts. And you know, I recently went to a panel where they were talking about how crowdsourcing is the wave of finance, or, you know, the wave of the future for financing creative projects. I don't know if that's the case, especially when everyone is strapped for money. And as I imagine, like the two of you, I have a lot of friends who are in the arts. And so I have a lot of friends with Kickstarter campaigns. Yeah. And there's only so much money that I can, you know, put out. I like to try to contribute to my friends' projects. But you know, after a while, I think people get inundated with those requests. And I'm really curious about the sustainability of that model. But, you know, that said, I've had a Kickstarter campaign in the past that was successful. It was very helpful. And it feels good to not just to get the money, but to know that you have people that support you and who believe in what you're doing.
Well, just as a question I'd like to ask, you were on the panel, a grant panel, and you're seeing submissions from lots of filmmakers. What was your reaction to seeing those?
Wow. I have to say it was probably one of the most intense weeks of my life because there are approximately, I think, 1,400 different work samples, and we only have a finite time to view a portion of those. There's a lot of incredible work. And again, I think more people are doing this type of work because of the accessibility of the equipment. You can get a camera, you can get sound equipment, you can get an editing system for very cheap. There's a lot of great work and a lot of people working in different genres and different modes. And yeah, I'm not sure what else to say about it. It's a lot of information, though.
Was this the NISCA panel or the... are you talking about NYFA?
NYFA. It was the NYFA panel for the fellowship, for the Fellowship in Film Video this year. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, having myself been declined a grant here and there, I always find it helpful to ask why I was not accepted. And if you were to give advice to those who did not get a grant award or a fellowship, what would be your sort of common denominator?
I would say don't take it personally because there's so much work. And it's even after you've gone through, let's say, 1,400 different samples, you still have this pile of work that's incredible. And you know, it just, grants can't go out to everybody. But that doesn't mean, yeah. You know, there was a grant that I applied for a few years ago, and I really, really wanted this grant. And the grant giver actually contacted me afterwards and said, you know, yeah, we couldn't give you the grant because we had a lot of great projects, but I just want you to know, keep doing what you're doing. So that was, it was always helpful to hear, but,
I would like to say something before we leave that,
sure,
that, I have been very fortunate with this project, and I have gotten two NISCA grants, and I also have gotten one grant from the Peter S. Reed Foundation. and the rest of the money I've raised on my own. But those have been incredibly helpful.
And ideally, when would you like to see, Isabel, this film completed?
I would like to start editing right now. I've taken some time off for personal reasons, but I'm back and I'm ready to go to work.
Excellent. Well, anything else in closing? Because we unfortunately have come to the end of our wonderful hour with Julie Casper Roth and Isabel Barton. Ladies, any closing words of wisdom?
I just want to say it was really nice to meet you and to have this conversation.
Yes, I would like to thank you too. And I think it's wonderful. I would like to keep going with some conversations with you. And I want to thank you for having us here.
Thank you.
And I want to tell all the filmmakers out there, don't give up, because the grant does come and the help does come from the community and from the people you know. And the rejections are the daily bread. And we celebrate the rest.
I like that advice, daily bread. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you both ladies for being here as part of the Art of the Hudson Valley. And that concludes this month's program. I want to remind our listeners, all of the Art of the Hudson Valley programs are archived at WGXC.org. You can listen globally, which is a wonderful thing about the internet and this wonderful radio station, WGXC.org. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Art of the Hudson Valley. And don't forget, create. Put down there.